Blog Talk Radio.
Radio program. I'm Susan Larison Dan, and I am just so in a space of really pure joy this morning, welcoming you on this absolutely beautiful fall day in the Pacific Northwest, coming straight from a wonderful walk in nature to this show today, where I have an absolutely wonderful guest who is returning to the show to talk about her new book, and that is PMH Atwater. PMH, who many of you know already, is internationally recognized as one of the top researchers in the world in near-death experiences, also known as NDEs, and she has actually experienced the phenomenon firsthand 3 times. Today, we are going to talk about her latest book, just released, called Dying to Know You, Proof of God in the Near-Death Experience. And PMH has written many books. She has written more than 15 books. And she is a pioneer in the field of studying NDEs. And she has listened to close to 4,000 what are termed as experiencers, both children and adults who have shared stories of their near-death states. Her latest book is very special, and we will talk about it in a moment, how it brings her work together. And really, the collective work, not just hers, and she'll be very clear on that, I'm sure, and is in her book. It brings it together in the space of the heart, and it conveys just what is at the heart of everything. I'll tell you just a little bit more about PMH. She's won many awards. She speaks worldwide. Always an honor to have her here because she's been in such luminary places as Larry King Live, Sally Jesse Raphael, Regis and Kathy Lee. She's been on Coast to Coast AM several times. She's spoken at the United Nations. She has spoken at IANS, which is the International Association for Near-Death Studies. And she really is one of the most well-known and most knowledgeable authorities on this topic, and yet she is also very much a person of the heart because she is a prayer chaplain, she is a spiritual counselor, and in her everyday life, day by day by day, she walks the walk of being a person who has been touched by something very special in the collective and shares that with all of us. So without further delay, I am just so happy to welcome back PMH Atwater to the show. Hello, PMH. How are you today?
Well, hello. My goodness, after an intro like that, you know, let's face it, you just love rascals. Because I'm a rascal by nature.
I guess so. You know, I don't know where they come from, PMH. I don't, you know, that one just flows.
because it just, I feel, see, now, look at, now I'm speechless. Isn't that interesting? That should tell you right there how it flowed just a minute ago, straight from a place well beyond me, because I think many, many out there in the collective feel this way about you and the work that you're doing here. I mean, it's just, we are just very thankful that you are in the world and that you're here on this show.
This new book humbles me. It absolutely does. Dying to Know You, Proof of God in the Near-Death Experience, what it's about, what it contains, how it ever came to be. I mean, all of that is above and beyond me. I want everybody in Radioland to realize that this is the first and only book ever written that is, that consists of the collective voice speaking as a collective about the collective experience. So this is not a research book. This is not an opinion book, a philosophy book, a religious book, a personal story. It's none of that.
Yes.
It is the people themselves speaking as they speak about what they saw, felt, and, you know, and learned and experienced. And because of that, I'm just absolutely overwhelmed by the power in this book. It's just a little bitty book. It's not very big, but it's so much power in it.
Yes. Yes, it really speaks to the heart of the matter. And it really, you know, I know many are listening who are familiar with some of your previous works, which are just filled with just wonderful detail everywhere. And they certainly, you know, provide a wonderful picture of what people have experienced. And yet this book, PMH, it is different. It gets really to the core of it all. What are these experiences telling us all, and what's being communicated beyond each individual experiencer?
And it does so very briefly. You know, it's a quick read, but it's a Sakatuya book. It really is
it
a Sakatuya book. I've been on a number of radio shows now, and the majority of the radio hosts, while I was on the show, said to me, and I could tell by their voices, said to me that that book had changed their life.
Yes, yes. Well, it goes beyond. There comes a point where it's more of a feeling experience than even all the details. They all fall away, and what is the light really shining upon here? What I think in your book you say 90 to 95%. Return absolutely convinced God exists. I find that just fascinating.
Oh, yeah. And they won't all agree on what to call God. But the idea of a creator God, a source place, a presence, a power, they all agree on that. Well, I can't say all because that's a very big word. But I'm going to say 90 to 95%, which is pretty close. And, you know, even atheists who come back still atheists talk about this, the way they feel, the power that they are filled with. These people come back more compassionate, more understanding, more loving, more glowing, absolutely glowing. And, you know, they were touched by something huge, and they know it, and they admit it. But they won't use the word G-O-D or anything like that. And many of them wind up in an atheist church. You know, did you know atheists have a church? They do.
Well, they have the Spaghetti Monster Church. I know that.
Yeah. Well, you know, they have churches. And, you know, many of them wind up going to one.
Yeah. Actually, I think how we define church is very limited, in that I've read works of atheists where they have just glorified creation. I mean, honestly, in their own way. And so And that to me is the voice of the collective, because, and we miss that sometimes, is that, and maybe sometimes they don't want to hear it if they haven't actually had a direct experience in some way, but deep down underlying the words is still that experience of the collective, of God. It's shared by all of us and expressed in their own way.
Yeah, and I think this is why this book is so important. And you know, I don't know how to explain the language in it. It's simple. It's easy to read, and it's flippant. And sometimes it's irreverent. And it just comes right out. Because, you know, we've reached the point now, today, 2014, we've reached the point now where we have to speak the words. We can't dilly-dally around anymore. We can't disguise them anymore. We can't be diplomatic anymore. We've got to say what we know in our heart is. And one of the things we have to come out and say, and the experiencers say this, so it's now time, everybody else heard it, that is, a near-death experience is a spiritual experience.
Yes.
Period. It is. I don't care if you're a doctor. I don't care if you're a scientist. I don't care if you're a lawyer. I don't care if you're a housewife, a kid. I don't care who you are. The near-death experience is a spiritual experience. Are they all wonderful? No. But they are challenging. They all change you. They all shift you. They all turn you around.
Yes, yes. Transformative. They change you forever, and they change those who hear about it in many ways. And you know, lately, PMH, you know, you talk about just how many people, I mean, you've only talked to yourself, you've talked to a substantial number of people about these
experiences. Yeah, nearly 4,000, but, you know, they represent millions.
Yes.
This book is representative of millions and millions of experiencers globally.
Yes, and I would wager many of us know one. And, you know, it's funny, I synchronistically, just in my area in my life, there's someone who is an experiencer who's not familiar with all the things written about it, and you know, was talking to me. It was a huge synchronicity that she just happened to meet me in a certain way, unrelated to anything spiritual. And it really made me think, PMH, about, you know, you see the reality of it through their eyes. And so I got to kind of observe this myself, in the sense that even with you, in fact, you know, maybe we should go back to your story for those new to your work, how you didn't know about any of this. And this is very much what I hear from, you know, I happened to hear something similar to this recently, and I think it's quite common. I mean, you don't have to, people experience this without knowing anything about the phenomenon. So, yes, why don't we re-enter? You haven't been on the show in a little while, and I invite people to listen to the previous shows, but let's revisit your story just a little bit, entering into this. How you got into this topic to begin with?
I think it's fair to say that I was very deeply into metaphysical, mystical investigations and thoughts long before my experience. I got into it in the 60s. Actually, I think I was born into it, but really got into it in the 60s with the Findhorn Gardens and Seth Speaks and all these incredible ideas and people that were just popping up all over. And the idea that there's more to life than what we think, there's more to the human body than what we think. So I got so deeply into it with experiments and investigations of various kinds that I started, I come from Idaho, and I started Idaho's first nonprofit metaphysical corporation called Inner Forum. And Inner Forum had a monthly newsletter. We brought in speakers. I went to all the major churches in this city, in Boise, that's the capital city of Idaho, And I told them about Interform. I told them what we were doing, that our job, as we saw it, was to bring in the facts, to bring in real information to counter all the junk that was on the bookstore shelves. You know, I mean, let's look at the real thing from various points of view and discuss it. And they all agreed. I never, in all the years that Interform ran, I never had any problems with any minister of any religion of any church in Boise.
Yes.
Because they knew Interform, and they knew what we were doing. So I'm very proud and happy to say that. So here I am, very active with thousands of people, and I was investigating and having personal experiences and research with easily 3,000 people. Easily,
yes.
3,000. I mean, this was a big concern.
Yes.
And then I got to laugh here. I reached that point where I think all of us reach, where we feel like, you know, we've learned everything that we can learn at that point in our lives, and then this incredible knowing comes forward, this old saying that says, when the student is ready, the teacher will come. So I felt like, you know, I'd really done it. Isn't that stupid?
Yes.
Anyway, I'd really done it. And I'm going to get a new teacher. Yeah. And I'm going to get to a new level. Yeah. You know, I was all ready for that.
I'm sure you were. Little did you know.
I was expecting a person. I got deaf instead.
Uh-huh.
And that's when I died, 3 times in 3 months. Now, I've got to tell you, with all that I had done before, I was only prepared in 2 ways. Number
yes.
one, I could exist without an ego. Didn't need an ego.
Yes.
Number two, I was not frightened or concerned about any kind of space I might be in. So I was very comfortable with other dimensional stuff. So
yes.
So I was prepared in those 2 ways. But that wasn't enough. I was just as traumatized as anybody else. My near-death experience, and you find this in most near-death experiences, according to the individual and how prepared they are, how knowing they are, where they are in their life,
yeah.
They seem to get what they need. So you're going to get whatever will stretch you. And if that's a simple out-of-body experience, that's what you're going to get. If that's a simple voice in the darkness, that's what you're going to get. Doesn't matter. So I got 3 experiences that were so far above and beyond anything I knew, had heard of, or could handle, that I was just simply stretched every which way and cut in half and chopped up in little pieces. I'll tell you, I was just hard hit by these experiences. And of course, as I always remind people, most near-death experiences come from violence or trauma.
Yeah,
so I had to rebuild my body afterward. That is to say, I had to relearn how to crawl, how to stand, how to walk, how to tell the difference between left and right, hear properly, see properly, and rebuild all my belief systems. So I spent a whole year really in therapy, day and night, exercises, you know, just trying to be a human being again, and still dealing with what I'd gone through. Now, the first one was kind of an initial experience. That was January 2, and it was caused by a miscarriage and extreme hemorrhaging. Second
yes.
one, 2 days later, so we're talking January 4, and that was a major thrombosis in the right thigh vein, which dislodged, followed by the worst case of phlebitis the specialist had ever heard of, let alone seen. And then the third one was 3 months later, March 29. And nobody is, I mean, the medical community still to this day are not certain what it was that killed me. There was no vital signs. They think it might have been a stroke or a heart attack. They just can't tell for sure. But whatever it was, I was pretty well gone.
Yes.
But it was that third one. All of them were just, you know, like real shakeups. But that third one, part of that third one, I heard this voice. I really felt like I was at the center point of creation and consciousness and was able to witness creation as it actually occurred.
Mm-hmm.
And part of that witnessing, out came this voice that spoke to me. And I want to be clear here that this is not a guide. This is not a light being. This is not an angel. This was not a deceased loved one. This wasn't any of those kinds of voices. This voice was so big, bigger than bigger than big, you know. It was so immense that it filled the whole universe, you know, and then some.
Yeah.
Huge voice. And his voice said, and I quote, "Test revelation. You are to do the research. One book for each death." Then it showed me what that meant and what was to be in each book. It did not name book one. I really feel that coming back to life was book one, but it didn't name book one.
Mm.
Book two is future memory.
Yeah.
And if you haven't read Future Memory, you got to read Future Memory because it's not like any other book. It's a labyrinth. It's really not a book.
Oh, yes, it is. And in fact, I invite the listeners. There's a show we did on it a while ago, and it is a very interesting
book. It's a very, very different kind of book. And then the third one was a manual, which I've started to work on this year. Don't know how long it's going to take me to finish it, but I finally started on it. Actually, the manual was the first book I ever wrote and sent it out to peer review, and everybody that reviewed the thing contacted me back and said, "Put this in a box. The world isn't ready for this yet."
Wow.
So I put it in a box, and it's been there since nearly four decades, and I finally opened the box this spring because of the death of Robert Vandecastle, who's the world's leading authority on dream states.
Yeah.
And because of his death, and he came to me afterward and what he told me, that I finally opened the box. So I'm into the book, but that's all. It's, you know, who knows how long it's going to take. So what drives me and what I do and where I believe my energy comes from is from that voice, absolutely that voice. And because I'm a cop's kid raised in a police station, I'm insistent on unbiased, thorough, cross-checking, verified work. So I've demanded that of myself, and I have held to that credo. And I took my own experience and sort of blanked it out or put it on a shelf in my mind so it'd be a blank slate where everyone else could write their experience. So I did everything I could not to allow what happened to me and what I saw and learned to interfere in any way with my work. And you're going to be interested in this. Gee, when did this happen? That was this year. I think it was, April of this year. I noticed in the journals that are being, the papers that are being published in journals now, with various doctors who've taken my work and done their own work, none of them are noting me. There's no notation of my previous work at all. And they're taking my stuff and they're enlarging on it, which is great, but they're not giving me any credit. So I wrote one of the best researchers in the field, one of the best psychiatrists in the field, a man I just have so much respect for, and I said, and really, really like, and I said, you know, why is this happening? You know, why am I not being notated anymore?
Yes.
And his answer struck me like a blow. And his answer was, and I quote, "Your work will never be accepted."
Wow.
And it's just like, whoa. So I went through 2 weeks of absolute grief and guilt,
yes,
and shame.
Yes.
The guilt and shame because I had promised God I would do this work. I was told to do it, promised God I would do it, and,
yes,
you know, devoted my life to doing it. And here I'm being told that my best work will never be accepted, and I felt like I'd let God down. You know, I don't know if anybody can understand that, but that's how I felt. I felt like I'd let God down. And then after 2 weeks of that, I just suddenly stood up straight, shoulders,
yes,
back, stomach in, and said, now, wait a minute here. I know I've done a good job. I know my work is verified.
Yes.
I know that I did exactly what God told me to do, and I did a good job of doing it. And if I miss the brass ring, well, at least I'm leaving a legacy. So I decided to just, if you'll pardon the phrase, to heck with anybody else. And I would just let, I would let myself get out of the way. So I decided, to heck with being a researcher, I'm just going to be me, and I'm just going to let it out. And ever since then, people say, you're speaking now better than you ever did before. What happened to you? And I'm tempted to say, I've been shamed to the point that I didn't care anymore.
So it was a gift, PMH, in a way. Isn't that the way source works,
yes,
in a sense?
It was. You know, if I missed a brass ring, well, so I missed a brass
ring. Well,
and
it's one person's
opinion. You can't argue
opinion
with the bulk of my work. Yeah.
See, I would tend to, you know, when I hear this, honestly, it gets me a little riled up because I'm thinking, I don't care or know who this is, and it doesn't matter, but it's just one voice. I don't care how respected someone is. I mean, there would be countless others who would say exactly the opposite. I mean, just look at the testimonials in your book at the beginning. I was almost going to, my intro would have been way too long. I wanted to read some of them. I mean, they are amazing. And so many of us think you are amazing. And so the way that I view this is it's a voice that, you know, triggered you in a way and maybe needed, and it was a gift because now you're bringing yourself fully to us. And
well,
that's your book so much,
you know,
too. On, you are in it so much.
On top of that, you know, we've already noted that Dying to Know You, Proof of God in the Near-Death Experience, is not like any other book I've ever written. And it,
yes,
is not. It's absolutely not. Last year, well, this is how it all came to be.
Yes.
I was on an airplane flying to San Francisco for 2.5 weeks of giving talks. So I'm sitting in the airplane. I'm minding my own business. I'm just sitting on a seat. And the air in front of me, and I want to emphasize this, air. You know, not a disincarnate, not an angel, not a voice, not an ascended master, none of that. Just,
yeah,
air about,
yeah,
1.5, 2 feet in front of me. Started writing a book. And first came the title page, and then came the frontispiece, and then came the table of contents, and then came 11 chapters, and then came the back matter. And it just kept going and going and going. And I looked at this stuff, and I thought to myself, after it had been going for a while, you know, maybe I ought to get out a paper and pencil.
Time to listen.
I started writing it down. Well, for that 2.5 weeks I was in California, every time I had a spare moment or things were quiet, that air would start up again. It was like a computer loop. It would just keep going and going and going. Well, I'd keep writing and writing and writing. And finally, I got angry. I did. I felt violated. I felt like I had no choice in this. I mean, what is this? I don't understand this. What is it for? This is not the way I would write. What's this all about? Yeah. And I was staying with a friend of mine, and he took me to see the redwoods. You know, that's a big deal for me to see the redwoods.
Oh, absolutely.
I love those trees.
Wonderful, wonderful.
And we drove through a little town in Northern California called Felton. And Felton is a very funky little town. It is so funky. It has its own Sasquatch Museum. I just think that
sounds like Oregon.
Well, Oregon has some funky towns, too. I've been all over
Oregon. Well, yeah, I live in a funky place, too, so I know.
And, you know, it has this big white antique barn, and right next to it is kind of a nondescript but nice-looking wooden building. And on the street sign, it said Greek Orthodox Church. And I thought, whoa, this is where I'm going. Fortunately, the doors were not locked. I went right inside that church, right to the Holy of Holies, and I'm down on my hands and knees and my forehead to the floor. And I'm really sort of begging and wanting and desiring very much some guidance here. Like, what's going on? And I hear this very soft, grandfatherly voice. And it says, hush, child, hush, child, now do your work. And that alleviated the stress and the trauma on my part. That said to me, it's okay. You can do this. It's all right. So I did. And a couple of months before the book was to be printed, it was all done. A couple of months before it was printed, the air came back.
Yeah.
And it added 2 more chapters. So it now has 13 chapters. And then it was printed. But do you know, this is so wild, just before this fall, you know, so we're talking last month, this fall, when I was just 2 hours before I got on the plane to go once again to California, this time to Newport Beach, California, to be one of the presenters at the big near-death conference there.
Yes.
2 hours before, I still had the computer on before I made the rush to get the airplane. The announcement came through on the internet about this incredible scientific finding that has now been scientifically verified about DNA that we in Western science missed it. We absolutely missed it. DNA has 2 languages, not 1. We in Western science focused on the particle, that is to say, the more physical part of the DNA, the rest of it we called junk DNA, come to find out the so-called 97% junk DNA is what controls the other part, that it is an energetic. It is a vibratory processing movement that manages and decides what DNA does. It is the controller of DNA. So DNA consists of 2 parts, not 1. It is both the linear and the nonlinear, and you can't have the DNA, the linear, without the nonlinear. So if you stop and think what this means, what all has DNA? You know, trees, grass, you, me, dogs, cats, the world.
Yes, yes.
And it's saying that what you and I call an aura or field or a vibratory field around something or the color around something is DNA.
Yes.
It
yes.
is the function of DNA. That DNA is both the particle and the wave simultaneously, which says all of creation is both the particle and the wave simultaneously.
And that tells me it's all light.
And chapter 12 in this little bitty book,
yes,
I just really stretched scientifically and said things
yes.
I should never say because I'm not a scientist. And that revelation, that scientific verification,
yes,
validates every word I said in chapter 12.
Yes.
That little bitty chapter will blow your mind, and it has all now been scientifically verified. And it
magically.
And it came from air.
You know, I have to say something has happened here in this room. I don't know, should I say this? We interrupt this broadcast for something rather magical. If you don't mind my interjecting it.
Okay.
Well, I'm gonna quickly tell you a story and then you'll understand.
Okay.
I guess it was a few years ago, my sister had a dream catcher made for me.
Uh-huh.
And it's very flamboyant, by the way. It's all purple and kind of, it's all very flamboyant would be the word I would say. And when I saw it at first, I thought, wow, that's for me. Well, when you started talking, and I didn't quite catch this in the book so much, although I know I read it, when you started talking, and actually there's a story behind this too. A few days ago, I thought to myself, what in the heck did she mean by the grandfathers? Because, and I just climbed on top of my bed because I'm sitting here in my, that's where I do the show. It's the best place in the house where I do my show. And the dream catcher's up above me. And I said, I have got to get this thing down while she's talking. And look at what the card says on it. The card, which I will send or put on the page, on this thing. A dream catcher made by some Native Americans in a very, apparently she was in tears when she gave this to my sister, this woman, says on the back of the card, which I haven't looked at in years, a few years, transmutation, in quotes, listening to the voice of the grandfathers.
Wow.
Live right now. And I will happily send you, and actually post to the page later, which I can do, an image of not only the card, but the dream catcher. And I had to interject that because it's the magic is happening right here live. And I was led to it a few days ago because I asked the question, you know, what did it mean? I've wondered that for years. What does it mean? Although it's plural, the grandfathers. This woman who made this could not have been more sincere. And I think there might have been more than one. I'm going to have to find the history of just where this came from and how it came to be here. It's been over where I do my show for years. That's hanging on the wall. And you said this, and there you go. I'm losing my voice. There it is.
it is with a capital I. It's doing this everywhere. You know, people grab this book and they're changed.
Magic.
Well, I don't, you know, magic is a fun word to use.
I
know. Kind of
miracles.
Titillates us.
Miracles.
But I look
yeah, we have to be
at
careful
it as present.
That.
It
well,
has
me, many
present.
Connotations. Yes, yes. And I
because
like
this
to
is
use
what
it.
We're learning about DNA.
Yes.
It's not just particle, it's also wave, which means a presence.
Yes.
So when we're drawn to a tree or a rock, we're drawn to the presence because it's that presence that is the soul. Look at the idea of person and soul. You and your soul. Of course you have a soul. You have an energetic frequency modulator that directs and helps to keep you on track. We call it a soul.
Yes.
You have, everything is in soul. We now know why. Because everything has DNA. DNA is the cosmic internet. But above and beyond that, it is the cosmic wave that manages and leads and guides all manifestation.
Yeah.
So when we're talking about grandfathers, we're talking about these incredible wave-like spiritual, we use the word spiritual, they're wave-like power grids.
Yeah.
And I look at that and I just, you know, when you're talking about the soul, and in the book I do, you know, and in the book, of course I do.
Yes,
I don't talk about it. Everybody else talks about it in the book.
Of course.
And they're talking about the light, you know, the light in near-death experiences. And adults will describe that light as brighter than 10,000 suns. You're instantly fried, but there's no pain. Now just hang there a minute. If we're talking voltage here. We're talking absolute voltage. We're talking an energetic here, a frequency energetic, a voltage. And when we're talking in souls, we're also talking voltage. And in the past, there's been various doctors very curious to see if the soul has any weight. In other words, can we prove or at least indicate that there's something different about the soul, that it's not just a word we're using or a preference we're using or a spiritual belief that we're using, but it's an actuality. So there was, in the 1900s, there was a Dr. Duncan McDougall, who conducted an experiment in his hospital where he worked, and certainly with permission, he'd get these people about to die, and he would put them on one of these large scales, and then when they actually died, he'd measure them before, and then when they actually died, he'd measure them again, and the weight that was lost was somewhere between a half ounce to three quarters of an ounce to maybe an ounce.
Mm-hmm.
And 6 years later, another doctor, a whole team of doctors at a Massachusetts hospital, did the same thing to see if they could replicate Dr. McDougall's work.
Yeah.
And they got the same thing. With every single person that died, there was a sudden dispersal or loss of right around an ounce of weight. Now, an ounce of weight doesn't sound like very much, but think in terms of a microchip and how much information is on a microchip.
Yes.
And then imagine how much a full ounce could carry.
Yes.
And then you get the idea of, we're living in an electrical magnetic world. Our world is electric. And so when we're talking soul, we're talking electricity. We're talking something that has voltage. And for the soul, about an ounce, who knows what God has. We have no way to measure that except what people talk about when they come back from experiences like this. But, you know, near-death experiencers say, yes, we have a soul. Yes, there is a God. Yes, we are larger outside of our body than we are inside. Yes, the soul possesses voltage strength. There is a feel to its potential. So we're talking yes, yes, yes. And you know, it's just like, wow. Wow, we're talking about something that is dynamic here. We're not just talking about fairy tales or people's stories. And I love it with kids, you know. Kids always call God, or this idea of being in the presence of God, or near God, or feel that feel of God, they always call that a father figure. You know, it's he, him, father. And adults seldom do. Adults seldom use the term, any gender term at all. But children often will. But it's interesting to me that every once in a while some kid will ask this God figure, is that what you really look like? Yeah, I mean, a true kid. And instantly that father figure will burst into this incredible light. And they'll do the same thing with angels. You know, most kids see an angel with wings. Sometimes the angel is black, like a black color crayon. Sometimes the angel is white, like a white color crayon. And sometimes the angel is colored. And that's what children use that term. And what they mean by that is they have skin tones the same color as people do. So that we have the really, really black ones, we have the really, really white ones, and then we have the angels with skin tones like anybody and everybody else has.
Yeah.
And they will sometimes ask these angels, as, you know, as far as what they look like, and invariably, the angel will do the same thing God did, burst into this incredible light, although the light won't be as big. It's God.
That's so amazing.
and the kids talk about these three lights, and I think I've mentioned this before on your show, but I think it's appropriate to mention it again now.
Oh, definitely.
They come at, they're very clear about the three lights on the other side, and a lot of adults are too. They talk about this raw, piercing light. Really doesn't have a color. It's sort of like a radiation or a luminosity, but it's very raw and piercing. Very strong. And then there's this black or dark light that often has purple tinges in it. And there's something about that dark or black light that's very comforting and very healing and very cuddly, warm, and wonderful.
Yeah.
Very seldom do you ever hear a near-death experiencer talk about that black or dark light as being negative or demonic or this kind of thing. Sometimes you do, but most times you do not. In fact, it's just the opposite. And then there's this white light or really, really bright light. Some people say it has gold or silver tinges to it. And this is that light that emits this incredible unconditional love, this light is very creative, very welcoming, as brilliant, as powerful as this light is. It knows your name. It knows all about you. You can't fool this light, and you can talk to this light. So the kids interpret all of this as, well, that very raw, piercing light, that's God's light. And that really dark or black light, that's another light. And that really, really bright light, that's Father light. And that Mother light and Father light come from God's light. So that the primary light is that piercing voltage, that you know, that light that is so powerful that it just takes over everything and annihilates everything and just absorbs everything.
Yes. Now, PMH, I know that we've spoken of this on the show before, and you address this in your book, and it's so very important, is many people feel that they will be judged when they cross over to the other side. And although you say that this light knows you, can you speak, because I know you speak to this in your book, and it's so important to understand what would you say to judgment, and what are people saying about their experiences? Because this light, people, in the way that many fear.
The interesting thing about judgment, there kind of sort of is. And you run across more judgment accounts with children than you do with adults, which I find very interesting.
Interesting.
Very often with children, they will be greeted by a caring or strict parental type figure.
Yes.
And sort of brought up short in the sense that this is what is expected of you, this is why you're here in this lifetime, this is what we want you to do. And sometimes kids will have to face a tribunal. Now, sometimes it's of animals instead of people. And again, this idea of this is what you've been doing thus far, this is what you're here for, this is how we expect you to act in the future. So it's kind of like a parental kind of thing with kids. And they don't all have this kind, but most, a large amount of them do. With adults, sometimes there can be this sense of guilt or shame or gee whiz kind of stuff. And invariably, they are shown or come to feel that there's really no judgment here. That it's not God judging you, but it's you judging you.
Mm-hmm.
And the biggest expression of this, I believe, is the life review.
Mm-hmm.
Because in the life review, sometimes it's a quickie, sort of like, you know, your life flashing before your eyes kind of thing. Sometimes you only review maybe a few scenes in your life. Sometimes it's from birth to death. Sometimes it's from death to birth. Many experiencers wind up in some kind of large room like a library, sometimes to read the book of life, their book of life.
Yeah.
They actually see a book on a pedestal and read it. Sometimes there are shelves, all kinds of shelves in this room going clear up to the ceiling, and filled with TV sets, and they're all on. And they're each playing a different aspect of the person's life. And it's up to that person to choose which one they want to go into and then explore that particular experience more. But for the average person, some way, somehow, the life review is just that. They are reviewing their life, many times reliving it from birth to death, usually, and what they've done, and then they're looking at it, and they are judging, well, I shouldn't have done that, or they're being shown the repercussions, they're being shown, or they're able to see or feel the pain that they caused somebody else. So the life review very often is like a learning experience or like some kind of kind teacher just kind of showing you what you did and let you decide, was that a good thing or was that a not-so-good thing? But sometimes these life reviews can be really painful and really radical. Usually they're the individual is detached and in an objective mode, so they're really having an opportunity to really look at the full dynamics of what was going on. But other times when you relive it, that's where it gets heavy, because some experiencers wind up reliving the pain and the horror that they caused somebody else, and the pain and problems that caused other people related to that individual. So you can go back several times here, the individual, the people related to the individual, you know, the children or the mate of the individual. So some people get that kind of heavy duty where they get it all, and they're reliving and feeling and undergoing again what happened, the results of what happened, and any pain or difficulty that caused. So some of your life reviews can really be kind of really rough.
Yes.
Most of them are objective. Most of them are kinder than that. But they're not all like that. Some of them are really heavy. So, you know.
Well, maybe that's just a wake-up call then, you know.
When we're talking judgment, in most cases, It's like a school, as it were.
Yes.
In the sense that you're having an opportunity to see yourself, what you did, the consequences of what you did, and then you are deciding, was that good or was that not good?
You know, there's
so
a quote
it's not,
from
it's
your
not God judging you.
Quote from your book I wrote down because it was kind of about this rediscovery process that can emerge. And you said, what needs fixing can be fixed. Who needs loving can be loved, unquote. And as I'm listening to you describe this, it's like it has, you know, PMH so many times, I mean, many of us have been taught a kind of judgment that has nowhere to go. You're judged and then, you know, thrown into the lake of fire and that's it, you know.
Yeah.
Or whatever. I mean, there's nowhere to go from there. I mean, there's no growth coming out of that. And yet, a loving, unconditionally loving source, you know, this quote of yours, what needs fixing can be fixed, who needs loving can be loved, and just what you're describing is transformative.
Well, this
judgment,
is what the children and adults both come back with. That knowing that no matter what it was that they saw and felt and relived, no matter what it was, whatever happened can be fixed. You know, whatever needs fixed can be fixed. Whoever needs loving can be loved. And that's huge. I mean, that just changes people's lives right there.
Yes.
It's just,
This is such an important topic for people out there, and I think, you know, we've got a half hour left, and those of you joining us at the top of the hour, and by the way, thank you, Blog Talk Radio. We've been on the front page for pretty much the whole show, and we keep progressing up the page in terms of there are 8 shows on that page, and that they feature at any one time, and I am thankful, and we may be getting some new people joining us. So I just want to remind people, I have PMH Atwater here, one of the top experts on near-death experiences. And I have a question for you, because I just feel this is so important to explore, maybe kind of twofold, one of my complex questions. First of all, you are one of the more, you are courageous and honest in your explorations of what people have observed. And in your book, you do talk about heaven and hell, in a way as to how people see when they have a darker experience. And I guess my question is, and you do reflect on this in the book, I kind of contrast, or this is reflected by something I read in the news recently, where they said more and more people in Christian churches and even conservative churches are questioning the concept of hell. And because of that, people are coming around with programs saying, you know, kind of scaring people back into believing in hell and in the eternal Lake of Fire version of it. And even on Twitter, when I communicated our show today, someone immediately responded in that way, kind of, you know, asking if I was saved, you know, because, you know, obviously very, very clearly concerned about this notion of an eternal hell. So, PMH, based on what you've observed in your book,
okay,
yes,
let's talk
you,
about heaven and hell.
Yes, let's talk
first
about
all,
heaven and hell.
First of all, let me say that once you die, most people are then faced with or see or feel all kinds of levels. It's like a layer cake of levels or dimensions.
Yes.
And you go to wherever it is you resonate. So what I'm talking about here, I'm not talking about what you think or what you believe you are. I'm talking about at the core of your being, that very deepest part of you, what you have made yourself to be, who you really are, above and beyond your own mind and your own thoughts. That vibration, that core vibration of you, that vibration determines where you go. So you're going to go to whatever level vibrates like you do. So you're going to go there. And if the experiencers are very upfront, they say, yes, there is a hell. Yes, there is a heaven. So let's look at this layer cake, if you want to call it that. All these different levels stacked one on top of the other. They are separated by frequency vibration, by the frequency of the vibration. So you have all these different levels. And in my work, I counted 12 hells and 12 heavens. I don't know if that's right or not, but that's what I counted. And those that are the lower levels, what some people might call hell, are the more dense, slow-moving, heavier vibratory fields. Those that most people call heaven are the lighter, finer, faster moving vibrations. And then, of course, you have those in the middle who are similar to what we have here on the earth plane. So you go to wherever it is you fit. One of the interesting things I've noticed, though, with these thousands of people is that there's no top and there's no bottom. You're not going to rot forever in hell, and you're not going to sit forever on a cloud playing a harp. It's not going to happen. This whole dynamic moves and is fed by your choice.
Yeah.
By choice. So however long it takes you to wake up and realize there's more to this than you thought, that forgiveness really works, and that reconciliation really is possible, and that you really can learn and grow and expand, then you will. And the idea of, okay, you keep growing and growing and growing, and off the top, where do you go? I don't know. But what I do know is that very clearly most experiencers come to realize that they, as a soul, in other words, the core of them, the spirituality of them, the spiritual truth of them, their core, their job here on earth is to become a co-creator with the Creator. That's their job. That's really what we're here for. We're not here to please Great Aunt Tilly. We're not here to participate with ISIS and bringing about a caliphate. We're not here to go hip, hip, hooray when Jesus comes back. We are here, it seems to be, to develop ourselves the very best way we can. to develop our mind, our potential, our creativity in the best way we can, and in doing that, have some kind of spiritual life or some kind of love life, love in the greater sense of cosmic love, or that greater love of one for another, and living that to the best that we can.
Yeah.
And in doing that, we move closer and closer to merging with our soul. I really feel that it is prayer and meditation that brings us closer and closer to merging with our soul and becoming one with who it is we really are. And these illuminating experiences, these transformations of consciousness, be it a near-death experience, baptism in the Holy Spirit, shamanic vision quest, kundalini breakthrough, mountaintop experience, awakening, I mean, I don't care what you want to call them.
Yeah.
Their purpose seems to be to raise our vibrations high enough that we can join with our soul and be more of a whole being, become more of who and what we really are. And what we really are is a spiritual being having an earthly experience. What we really are, perhaps, is we are becoming co-creators with the Creator. So if you look at this construct or this process of heaven and hell, what more fair, what more beautiful, wonderful way of enabling that godling to wake up and realize who they are. Can you think of anything more fair? I can't.
It makes complete sense. And, you know, I appreciate, PMH, how you address other types of transformative experiences as well. And you and I have spoken before about this, where part of my awakening was a transformative experience. But what started that was asking, show me the way. And one of the very first things that showed up was a friend who then led me to information that said almost exactly the same thing, that we are aspects of God having a human experience. And when I read that, I was like, oh my God, Eureka! I mean, I found it. It makes sense logically and in a love-based way. And then I went on to really experience that. My actual transformative experience happened after that. After that information came to me, it was then I had this dramatic experience where I got to experience it. And, you know, you talk about a big wow. I had this feeling, you know, days later, I am in the presence of the living God. I remember thinking that in my mind. I am in the presence, realizing I came from an evangelical background as a child and then later kind of rejected spirituality to a point. But that's what it was. And so you saying this, I know that so many of us have had what you talk about calling, you call it a big wow. That's it, right there.
Right, and that's what this book is about. It's about God. It's about our presence within that incredible power that we really can't put words on. You cannot name that power. There's no name. God, Allah, deity. There is no name that fits the power of that source, that presence.
Yes.
It's beyond name. And that's what a lot of these experiencers, most of these experiencers come back infused in. Of course, the big challenge is, what do you do with it when you get back?
Yep.
So, well, you know, that's where we hit the after effects, which are both physical and psychological. And that's what people are not, you know, they're not talking about. They're not talking about all of the after effects, and it's suddenly, wow, you know, what do I do with this? or what is this going to do with me? Either way works. But, you know, when you're coming back from an experience like this, sometimes, in fact, many times, in this experience, you are coming to terms with things you never thought you ever would.
Yes.
Things like abortions, aborted babies. Many times we'll be there when the mother dies, say, hey, woo, look at me. And they have a conversation about that. So we're talking about abortions. We're talking about missing twins. We're talking about birth trauma and pre-birth. What I've found in my work is that anyone can have a near-death experience regardless of how old they are, even if they aren't born yet. And with my child experiencers, one-third of them had pre-birth memory, going back to about seven months in utero. So it's almost as if around 7 months in utero, that brain is waking up. Now, that's the same time scientifically that we know that a baby can feel pain. And I hesitate to call it any other term except baby, because to me they are babies, even though they aren't born yet. So about that same time that the fetus, so-called, wakes up to pain, it's almost as if the brain is waking up too, and memory is starting to build. And there, if you get the book, I love this, if you get the book, the Big Book of Near-Death Experiences,
yeah,
and that literally is an encyclopedia of the entire field globally. It's the only encyclopedia of near-death experiences that exist. And in that book is a heading called Womb with a View.
Uh-huh.
Where I'm giving cases where the fetus died in the womb and remembered dying and remembered what happened, and then when they're born, and some of them are resuscitated, they're not necessarily, you know, it seems like they're born dead, but some of them they're able to resuscitate, they will, when they're old enough to have language, talk about that moment when they're still in the womb and what they saw and heard while they were still in the womb.
Yeah.
And there's some of the cases that are just absolutely shocking. And the case of Carol Gray is one of them. And I do talk about that in the book, and it's also in the Big Book. So, you know, if you're talking about near-death experiences, you're not just talking about people who have a soul quake, you know, a transformation of consciousness.
I love
soul
that
quake.
Term. I love that term, by the way.
Too.
You use it in your book.
You
it
get shook
perfect.
Up. You know, it's a soul
yes.
quake. It's not yes. necessarily easy. I just got through reading a book, and I'm going to give an endorsement on it. It's called To Heaven and Back by Lee Thornton. And I value her book so much because, yes, she had a near-death experience as part of, looks like she was going to lose her baby. She
uh-huh.
didn't, but she almost lost her life. A kind of a near plane crash, and it took her a decade or more before she could bring that experience forward and start to use it in her life, because it was so above and beyond. I mean, it was a wonderful experience, wonderful in the sense of light and love and what we're more familiar with, but it was so above and beyond anything she'd ever experienced in her life, that not only could she not talk about it, she couldn't think about it. She couldn't
yes.
process it. And it took her a long time before she got to the point where she could be open about something like that and bring it back to conscious awareness and start to do something with it. So I don't want the listening audience to think that that we're talking about a fairy princess here with her magic wand, and she, you know, sprinkles a little fairy dust over somebody, and you come back absolutely transformed. Well, that's kind of true and kind of not true. You come back shifted, but you're...
Yes.
But it takes time to be able to handle that shift, to know what it is, to feel your way through it, to feel your way through the after effects. Because there are changes in brain structure and function afterward. There's changes in the nervous system, the digestive system, and skin sensitivity. Many come back with electrical sensitivity, sensitivity to light and to sound, and to pharmaceuticals, loss
mm-hmm.
of the tolerance of pharmaceuticals. So
yes.
we're talking some pretty heavy physical after effects. You don't just come back kinder, more loving, and more of a humanitarian. All of that's true, but you get the other stuff too.
Yes.
And so that can result in periods of depression and confusion, like, what happened? Can I trust it? What is it doing to me? I'm different now. What am I going to do with this difference? I can't communicate the same way I used to. Everything looks so different. I don't want to stay in my job. I don't want to stay in my marriage.
Yeah.
What has happened to me? So these experiences are heavy duty. We're not just talking about an experience. We're talking about a phenomenon that consists of both the experience and the pattern of after effects. And when you're really, really honest, I think you have to admit that any type of intense transformation of consciousness can cause the same or similar after effects to a near-death experience. So we're
yes.
really talking about threshold experiences. We're talking about those experiences that take you to that knife's edge between
yes.
life and death, sanity and insanity, where you're having to face what it's all about and who you are and you know, what does this mean? So these experiences can be, you know, really big, and that's why I'm so excited and humbled by this little bitty book. I keep calling it little bitty book because I'm used to writing big books.
You do, and very intricate
you know that,
books,
don't
too.
You?
Detailed
big books that are a little hefty.
Yes, and
with
and,
lots of notes. You know, you've got your appendices, and you've got you know you have to verify everything. I'm used to those kind of books.
Yes, and everyone
like
has those out there as a reference. But when it comes to a big wow, you know, I'd like to say you packed a lot of wow in this little space. It's in this book.
Oh, it's just. You know, the experiencers are just right to the point. They don't fool around, so I didn't either.
Yes.
I just put it out there. You know, this is what they say about judgment. This is what they say about the borderlands. This is what they say about heaven and hell. This is what they say about love. This is what they say about joy. This is what they say about the big picture. This is what they say about mission. This is what they say about soul. So, you know, and it's time. You know, it's like... That statement I made when we first started the show, it's time to say this.
Yes.
Let's not hold it back and say, well, I want to compare this with religion or philosophy or spiritual thought historically. No, it's time that we take all the fetters off, take all the fluff off, take all of the academia off and the scientific jargon. And it's time that we just allow the experiencers to speak for themselves.
Yes. And it's really time that we realize, you know, what we view as authorities in our culture, like that voice that perhaps, you know, criticized your work, PMH, they aren't necessarily the authorities that we think they are. I mean, authority comes from experience. And I feel that people are finally having the courage. I mean, I feel that, you know, your book, of course, you've always been courageous, PMH, but, you know, you have the courage to just call a spade a spade. I mean, I guess I could say it in a really honest way. Just, you know, what is what? And, you know, I think that many people have been through this, by the way, other transformative experiences. I personally experienced that. You'll go through a period where you're others are trying to convince you you're losing your mind, or you yourself think you're losing your mind, and then they move through that, thankfully. Many people. I think there are many people who don't move through that, sadly, and that's a real problem in our culture, because these are very powerful experiences that go beyond what we've been told is science, and yet you are revealing, and others are revealing, the quantum physicists are revealing, that science actually verifies reality if it's allowed to go beyond the box and actually explore reality as opposed to what they want to think is reality.
We're talking about the electromagnetic spectrum. Our faculties can only pick up about 8 to 10% of that spectrum. Everything else is either ultra or infra to our faculties of perception. It's all there. We don't see it because we're not set up to see it. We don't hear it, and we don't feel it because we're not set up to see or feel or hear it. That's not how we're made. These kinds of experiences begin to dissolve more and more of that curtain or that barrier, and we start to see more and more of what's really there.
Yes.
And it's always been there. It's not, you know, again, let's get away from the magic wand thing. It's always been there.
Yes.
But now we can finally begin to recognize it or hear it or feel it or see it. And, of course, most people are not prepared. We're talking about an experience here that is global, that happens to anyone in any country, anywhere, under any kind of circumstance. So it's really a human experience across the board. And it shifts you, it changes you. What is it shifting? I believe it's shifting your electromagnetic field around you. As that field begins to shift, then your faculties of perception enlarge and accelerate and expand, and you're able to take in more. A lot of people say you become psychic. I really challenge the word psychic, because the word psychic at its core simply means soul. So if you've got a soul, you're psychic. And I think, and thanks to science and the new research on DNA, I can say everything's ensouled, whether it's a human being or not. We're all ensouled.
Yes.
We all have that. So the more you can dissolve those restrictions or that barrier, then the more you're going to pick up. Now, that's what your religious rituals and studies are all about. That's what your metaphysical and mystical studies are all about. They're all about helping you to become more sensitive, i.e., break down or dissolve more of that barrier. In simple terms, that's what's happening here. Now, prayer and meditation do the same thing. The more devout you are, the more loving you are, the more sensitive you are, the deeper you get into prayer and meditation and trying as best you can to live what you come to know. That also dissolves more of that barrier. So we start to have what we call spiritual experiences. Well, really what we're doing is simply dissolving the barrier to what's there.
Yeah.
And this is what I want to emphasize, this is what I want to say. Let's get beyond all of these isms and schisms. Let's get beyond all of these ideas, whether they be metaphysical or physical, doesn't matter. It's still all based on belief. Let's get into knowing. Let's get into what's really happening. And
yeah.
And that's what this little bitty book does. It
yeah.
gets us, in simple words, very quickly, beyond belief, into knowing what's there,
yes.
how does it work.
And that's the key. I mean, this term supernatural we hear so often, you know, what is that but the natural that we don't understand yet?
Yeah.
Or that
there's no such thing as supernatural. There's no such thing
natural.
As paranormal.
Yeah.
I mean, those are nonsense terms.
Yes.
They're all based on linear investigations and thoughts. They're not based on the full picture of anything. And we can go
yes.
right back to that scientific report. They're based on the particle, not the wave. You've got
yes.
to bring in the wave with the particle, or you don't have the whole thing. You don't have the real thing. That finding is a game changer. That finding is going to change everything on every level throughout this entire world in every discipline once we look at it and realize the full import of what they found. Because they also found that by interfering or somehow adding maybe a little tone or a little different vibration, they can instruct DNA to recreate organs, to recreate cells. So instead of having a kidney transplant, you can grow your own. This is the possible future of what can come from that discovery.
Yeah.
We can then communicate with DNA on its own level and instruct its managerial processing to do things a little bit differently.
Yeah.
And they're already starting to do this. They've already had some spectacular results. And I truly believe that once this, the full import of this discovery gets out there, it's going to change everything. Spirituality,
yes.
physicality, it's going to change everything. Because we're finally going to wake up and realize there really is a God. And this is how God works.
Yes. Well, with that said, PMH, we are at the end of our live show.
Wow.
And I want to remind, yes, it happened really fast. And I want to remind people that your website is pmhatwater.com. And just 1 minute before the live link goes down, and then I want to say my thank you to you in a minute, just want to remind people the next show is Monday, October 13th at 7 p.m. Pacific. I've got Reverend Michael J.S. Carter on from Ancient Aliens. And then I have another show with someone you know, PMH, Tuesday, October 14th at 1 p.m. Pacific with Dr. Linda Backman. He's going to talk about her new
book. Wonderful.
Yes.
She does very good work.
Yes. But let me, after saying that to the live audience, just saying to you, PMH, what a sincere thank you I have in my heart. You talk about heart in your book, and we didn't get into that too much because it just flows through everything you do, the heart. And key from my heart to yours for being here today and sharing what you're sharing with the world.
Oh, well, it's my privilege and my pleasure and my joy. Let's do it more often.
Oh, I'd love to have you on more often, and I just so appreciate your presence here and in the world. So Thank you so much.
Many thanks. Bye-bye.
All right. Take care. And with that said, thank you to the live audience who is leaving us right now. And I just, interestingly enough, energetically, my computer has gone blank, audience, which is interesting. I mean, we so blew the circuits today with PMH, and it's still on, but I won't be able to play the music this time. So I guess we will just play that music in our hearts to end this show. And I want you to listen to whatever music your soul is singing as you listen to the end of this show, which, you know, normally I would play a theme at the end, but it's just, you know, I tell you what, energetically, what we just heard was incredibly powerful. And I know I'm talking to the podcast audience now across time, and I always welcome you here. So, and I just want to remind you, frontierbeyondfear.com is where you can learn about all past and future episodes of this show. It is listener supported. I invite you to go there if you'd like to join the community supporting this show. And once again, PMH Atwater, whose appearances that are coming up are on her website, pmhatwater.com. She has a wonderful newsletter that I think many of you would appreciate. So I invite you to go to that site and explore her work. So again, as I wrap up this show, just with the music of your own heart, may you find peace. May you feel the peace and the love that so many experiencers in the collective are bringing to us all. You too, whether you are an experiencer or not, you are an experiencer by being on this planet. You can feel that love. May you feel it now. And may you hear the music. Take care, everyone.